these are my collaborators. And the study will be published in the summer, but I also, the first half is going to be what we published in the summer, and the second half, hopefully, I'll have some time to talk about some new unpublished work, which goes into more details and our thoughts about this thing.
Oh, I'm still wearing it, sorry.
Excuse me. I'll just put this on. Where's Bess on that pocket, I think? And then if you just slip that on, you catch it on.
Get my keys out. Okay, let's do this. Well, there's this obvious motivation that we know out there is a dark energy, and 70% of the universe are made of this stuff, and it would be nice if we could understand it. And cosmological constant is kind of the easiest explanation of what dark energy might be, and then you get the Sitter spaces, and so understanding the Sitter spaces is kind of paramount to understanding dark energy. And there are even some proposals out there by people at UW, that's our vice provost for research, so important person, for how you would try to find experimental implications of holography in the inflationary period. Basically, what he wants to say is that if you do this counting, if you think of holography as something that just counts for you a number of degrees of freedom, then there seems to be some discreteness which you might or might not be able to see in the CMB. But without actually having a holographic description of the Sitter space, you don't know whether this is something that could manifest itself in some measurable way or not. So what we want is not just the counting, what we want is an actually holographic description. Just like ADS, where you have more than just a counting argument. You know how to do the holographic map to a field to it. And of course, it's also interesting because quantum gravity on the Sitter space is something which many people said, well, that's so puzzling. It's kind of, we don't understand anything what's going on there, and we don't know what S matrices are. We don't know what string theory is. And the more we know about the Sitter spaces might help us understand string theory better, or quantum gravity in general much better than we do right now. Okay, let me recall briefly, all of you know that, but I just want to phrase it in a language which I can then translate to the Sitter space. What we know about the one example where holography works, or where we have a holographic description, namely ADS-CFT. So you can discuss this on two levels, and the level on this transparency is the level at which I'm going to do something bad here. So you can discuss holography in anti-de Sitter space just by making some general statements. If you have any theory of gravity and other fields on ADS in a regime where gravity is kind of semi-classical gravity is valid, so you want that the curvature radius in Planck units is much bigger than one, then you can come up with a dictionary quite independently of any explicit realization. You can say that if you have any such theory whose low energy effective fields with gravity plus some other fields in ADS, then this has to be dual to a conformal field theory on the d minus one dimensional boundary geometry where fields map to operators. The number of degrees of freedom is given by this m5 l cubed, basically by the Newton's constant is counting the number of degrees of freedom for me. And in particular, this field operator map maps the metric to the stress energy tensor. The left-hand side has to be UV completed. And then the question of whether you can or cannot UV complete any given low-energy effective theory will tell you whether the CFT on the other side actually can exist or doesn't exist. But the dictionary doesn't really depend on having explicit examples. This can be worked out quite generally. And basically, the whole dictionary just follows from the isometries of the space and the fact that if you think about, in abstract terms, what are the possible analogs of an S matrix you can define in anti-de Sitter space, you're automatically led to these boundary correlation functions. So boundary correlation functions are the one meaningful thing you can measure in ADS space, and therefore holography in ADS should always go via this dictionary. Of course, the great thing about ADS is you can take one more step. Maldacena told us that there's actually one particular example, and then from this you can derive a few more. But starting, at least there's one example where this actually works, and you can give names to both sides. So this gravity story on the left-hand side, you can UV complete by 2B string theory on this background. Even though nobody has actually, it's very hard to do this explicitly, but we all believe you can. And on the right-hand side, you can give the CFT a name. You call it N equals 4 super M Mills SUM gauge group. And then this number of degrees of freedom maps to N squared, and you also have some gauge theory expression for what the curvature radius is going to be. Okay, so what I want to do for the sitter space is the first part of the story. How does holography work? And the second part of the story, I hope I'll be able to tell you at some point, but not at this conference. So we don't have any real explicit examples, unfortunately. Here are the two guiding principles that will be incorporated in our version of holography. For one, we have horizon complementarity, by which we mean that we basically only want to describe the physics within one causal patch. We only want to describe what any given observer actually can see. We don't want to have to define meta-observables, which nobody can see other than people kind of outside your space-time. And the other crucial ingredient is the short version of it is kind of this little green box, don't mess with time. In ADS, you do the same. In ADS, you have this complicated holographic map which kind of maps local physics in the bulk into some in some non-local way to this boundary conformal field theory. But the one coordinate that never gets touched in all this is time. Time in the CFT is time in the bulk. And we basically do the same, and there are many reasons why you would want to do this. In the sitter space, the future infinity, the existence of future infinity is quite questionable. There are these things called Poincaré recurrences. Physics repeats itself, kind of. And you don't want to have to rely on the sitter space existing for arbitrary long times in order to define your theory. Also, the only de Sitter spaces which we have some confidence of existing in string theory are metastable de Sitter spaces. So again, this hints at the fact that you want to be able to do a holography which is valid here and now, so I can compare my de Sitter space, which is alive right now, to some field theory and study time evolution in the de Sitter space against time evolution in the field theory. And then if the de Sitter space eventually decays in the field theory, something violent is going to happen. The field theory captures the decay. And this is very easy as long as time is time and you only holographically kind of map the spatial coordinates to each other. Okay, let me first describe to you what the proposal actually is, how we think holography is going to work in the sitter space, and then I'm going to tell you how we can more or less derive this. I'll also tell you what more or less means. So here's the proposal. Gravity and other fields on the sitter space, again in this regime where it's meaningful to even mumble the word gravity, so you're in the semi-classical regime where the curvature radius is much larger than the Planck length, and this has to somehow be UV completed, is dual to gravity again, but this time on a one lower dimensional sitter space, coupled to two conformal field series, where these conformal field series are defined with a cutoff. The scale at which these conformal field series are cut off is 1 over the curvature radius, and the curvature radius is the same for the sitter d minus 1 and the sitter d. And of course, this whole thing has to be UV completed again, and I also can tell you what the 4-dimensional Planck scale is in terms of the 5-dimensional Planck scale and the curvature radius. Well, to some of you, this might look like Randall Sundrum, and indeed it should, because that's how we're going to derive it later. But let me say a few more things about how implications and how the scales work in this problem. So here's the one interesting thing about this. I just defined for you gravity in the sitter space in terms of gravity in the sitter space. So if I do this duality once, I can also do it twice, or three times, or four times, or five times. And then no matter what d I start with, eventually I always can go down to gravity plus some conformal stuff. So these are many, many conformal field series on either the sitter 2 or the sitter 1. Once you're down to 2 or 1 dimensions, quantum gravity is no longer a headache. Quantum gravity is something you can solve. So even so, the halfway in between steps might sound empty to you because I explained gravity in terms of gravity. This is really something which boils the gravity in the d-dimensional de Sitter space down to something which we can deal with.
Question.
Yes, sir.
You take conformal field theory like any conformal on the Sitter space, the theory is unstable because of the conformal coupling.
Well, because it has scalar fields, but I won't. This depends on the explicit examples, right? The scalar fields are there in the examples which you know for ADS because of this. Supersymmetry is always giving me my gauge bosons come with some scalar partners. So you wouldn't want to put any massless scalar fields conformally coupled on the sitter space, yes. So you're asking me, you're telling me it's going to be hard to find explicit examples, and this you kind of knew before. You knew before from this KKLT, which gets a metastable vacuum at the sitter space and strings you, that in order to get the sitter spaces, you basically have to fine tune. And you're just telling me the same thing again. It's if you want to have conformal fields with these properties, it's not a. Picking any random conformal field theory we know of, like n equals 4 super Hamiltonian won't do. And we'll see this show up many times later in the talk again. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about the scales that are involved in the setup. And this picture I could also draw for Randall Sundrum, but now I'm talking about the SDS. And this is the left-hand side of the story. So I told you, The thing which I want to describe holographically is five-dimensional gravity in the sitter space. And five-dimensional gravity is valid at all scales up to the five-dimensional Planck scale, and then you eventually have to UV-complete. And one way to UV-complete the sitter spaces, which we know of, is this KKLT construction, which at least gives me meta-stable the sitter four spaces in string theory out of some flux compactification by dialing certain numbers just in the right way. And 5D gravity is valid all the way up to here. So what I just told you is kind of the basic version of this duality, the one that can easily be established, is that on the right-hand side, I have a dual description that scales below 1 over L, because that's a cutoff I put into my conformal features. So I tell you this gravitational physics over here can be equivalently described by gravitational physics in one less dimensions with two conformal field series, both of which are explicitly cut off at the scale 1 over L. And I have some induced four-dimensional Planck scale, which kind of slid off the picture. But if you just look at this, the four-dimensional Planck scale is much higher than the five-dimensional Planck scale. 4D gravity is much weaker than 5D gravity, naively. And that's just a fake scale that didn't really have anything to do with the microscopic physics that's underlying this theory. All right, now you already see on the left-hand side we can do better. Even classical gravity goes up to to M5. There should be something going on the right-hand side as well. And that's, so you have to be able to extend this duality to the scales all the way up to M5, and then it becomes a little puzzling what it is. But our claim is that this is kind of now different at the SDS than from what you would see in Randall Sundrum. Basically, no new ingredients are required in this window between 1 over L and M5. The only things that are sitting there are these conformal field series, there's gravity sitting there, and then there may be some direct couplings between these two conformal field series. But the important thing is there are not going to be any new degrees of freedom kicking in the scale 1 over L. The basic thing that's happening at 1 over L, what makes conformal invariance broken at 1 over L, is that gravity becomes strong at that scale. And once I convinced you of that version, then you can even go one step further, where we now say, well, on the left-hand side, I required a UV completion. And just by writing down 5D gravity, I haven't yet told you what the UV completion is, and there might be more than one. Over on the right-hand side, I have a theory which, once I'm down to two dimensions or one dimension, this is UV complete all by itself. You don't need to do anything anymore. And you might as well say, well, if the right-hand side is UV complete and the left-hand side, I would need one UV completion. One thing you can do is just take the right-hand side as a possible UV completion of the left-hand side and say, this description that was valid up to M5 is valid for all scales, and then gives me a definition of what I meant on the left-hand side to begin with. All right, so if I do this all, then I end up with the claim that quantum gravity in the sitter space is dual to quantum gravity in the sitter 1 coupled to some matter, right? That was one of the things which we ended up with. Let me say a few words about why this is exciting and what does this actually mean, saying these words. So what is the sitter 1? The sitter 1 is just like any other one-dimensional system. It's just a Hamiltonian, right? We just have time, and the word the sitter 1 really doesn't mean much. All the things we are in a 0 plus one-dimensional quantum mechanics. The important thing is we still have gravity around. Gravity in 0 plus 1 dimension isn't too exciting, doesn't have any dynamics, but the one thing it does, it gives me a constraint. What it means to have gravity in 1 dimension is you study a reparametrization invariant 1 dimensional system, and you end up giving a constraint which tells me the Hamiltonian of the system is equal to 0. This sounds maybe unfamiliar, but a very popular example of this is the relativistic three-point particle, which everybody of us has seen in string theory textbooks as kind of the warm-up to strings. Where you have reparametrization invariance, you can pick the tall coordinate on your world sheet or on your world line arbitrary. And then this x dot squared is basically the simplest version of a Lagrangian of a conformal quantum mechanics in 0 plus 1 dimensions. And the only way in which we are going to generalize this is that the SDS action 0 plus 1 dimensions has the same generic form, but now we have to replace the x dot squared with some arbitrary large central charge. So these are conformal field series which have lots of fields. And depending on what background you want to describe, you have to put a different conformal field series in there. But the bottom line is that quantum gravity in the sitter space in any dimension ends up being dual to quantum mechanics with a Hamiltonian constraint. So that's a closed system. This Hamiltonian constraint is what people often refer to as a closed system. The wave function does not evolve. Right? If my Hamiltonian is 0, there's no time dependence in my wave function. And So if this is supposedly the quantum description of the sitter space, you might ask yourself, what are the observables? How can I measure anything in such a system where there doesn't seem to be any time dependence? Well, I'm not going to go into this much other than telling you this is actually a problem people have solved already for us. This is something that has been studied many, many times by smart people in the past a lot. And this quantum mechanics system of a closed time repolarization invariant quantum mechanics system is the framework in which you have to discuss quantum cosmology. It might sound counterintuitive that the wave function doesn't evolve, but when you're talking about the wave function of the universe, you have to get used to the fact that some things just aren't that intuitive anymore. You don't have the outside observers which can collect your wave function. You don't have measurements that come from outside and probe the wave function. And there's a lot of machinery that has been developed in order to study, are there any observables in these closed time repolarization invariant systems? Hartle was the one who kind of wrote a series of papers and a nice review article on this. Back then, they did this without really having this crisp statement which we get from the SDS. Back then, their motivation to study this came from mini superspace. Superspace in this context doesn't mean something that has to do with supersymmetry, but superspace is just a space of spaces. Naively, if you want to quantize gravity in the most straightforward way, what you want to do is you want to quantize a space of all possible metrics. You want to write down a Hilbert space, which is a space of all spaces. And because you can't do that, you go to mini superspace. You randomly take your metric and truncate the metric to only metrics that have an FRW-like form. And then the only variable is the scale factor in the FRW-like universe. And then you can quantize this. And that's called mini superspace. That's not really an approximation to anything. It's just a truncation. But they said all the issues which we are going to have to deal with in quantum cosmology should probably be captured in this quantum mechanics system that already has this feature that it's a time repolarization invariant closed quantum mechanics system. So we basically get precisely the same type of system. The only difference is in our case we really have this as a holographic dual of the sitter space and not as some randomly truncated toy model. What are the observables? Well, I'm not going to tell you much about them other than go read Hartle's review. If you understand them better than I, that's very nice. I still have to get used to them. But it's something that's worked out. And Hartle wrote a review. Horvitz and Maldacena actually used those guys in a recent paper when they were discussing the black hole final state. What they are called decoherence functionals. And roughly what you want to measure is what is the probability that given one event happened in the past, you get a macroscopic universe evolving along a certain path of classical, basically following classical equations, which decoheres from other possible classical histories of the universe. That's once you end up having a big universe, then various histories of this big universe don't have much quantum interference with each other anymore. So you want to determine a classical path of a universe by giving me a probability that at a certain time t something happened and at some later time t something else happened. You encode this in this series of projection operators which define a history for you, and then you can calculate decoherence functionals for those guys. Okay, so far I only told you what our claim is, right? I told you we believe the sitter space in d dimensions is dual to the sitter space in d minus one dimensions coupled to those conformal field series. So far I haven't given you any reason why this should be true, and that's what I want to do next. I also told you why I think this is cool, because it would actually give us answers to questions which we all want to know about the sitter space, what to measure in the sitter space, what are the right concepts of observables. And the way you're going to derive this is you have to believe that ADS-CFT works for Randall-Sundrum. Basically what this means, you have to believe the UV-IR correspondence works. It's the only kind of input you have to take on top of ADS-CFT in order to derive the SDS. So if you study ADS-CFT applied to Randall-Sundrum-like setups, you get a very similar statement to the one which I wanted to make, namely you have gravity coupled to cutoff CFTs, and the cutoff CFTs become on the other side putting some cutoff on your spaces. And let me review a little bit how this works, since Randall-Sundrum was already a few years ago. Randall-Sundrum just studied a very simple toy model where something like this is happening. They study gravity on anti-de Sitter space, so my action is just 5D gravity, cosmological constant, so I get an anti-de Sitter space. And then we put in a brain. And the simplest model of a brain, what Randall and Sundrum used, is some object like a membrane whose only property is it has some tension, has some finite energy per unit volume. And then you want to see how do the solutions look like. Well, which solutions are you interested in? You're interested in the ground state solutions, which are the solutions with maximum symmetry. we singled out one coordinate because I put in a sweep range for a 3+1 dimensional object. So the maximum symmetric solutions which you get have a maximum symmetric space on the 4D slice and then have this warp product form. So on the slice, you can either put a de-Sitter form, Minkowski form, and anti-de-Sitter form. And without the brain, you know that the solution, the maximum symmetric solution, just has to be anti-de-Sitter 5. So if there's no brain, then what this metric should describe is always ADS5, no matter what slice you put on your 4D as your 4D metric. And these are just three different slicings of the ADS5. De-Sitter 4, Minkowski 4, ADS4 slicings of De-Sitter 5. What the dual CFT to those three slicings is, it's just always the same n equals 4 sub Young Mills or whatever CFT was dual to your ADS. It's just living on different four-dimensional spaces on De-Sitter 4, Minkowski 4, ADS4. So those three different slices, even though they're the same space, have a slightly different dual CFT interpretation. Since it's a CFT, you can really conformally map from one to the other, but you kind of pick what metric you want to study your CFT on. So what does the brain do now? The brain is a space energy tensor that's only living on this one single co-dimension one slice. So the solution has to be ADS5 away from the brain. The only thing the brain is going to do is going to cut part of my ADS, and then you paste it back together in these two half ADSs, paste them back together along the brain. And you want to interpret this cutting off of the geometry as some cutting off in the CFT. And that's where you need UVIR. You want to identify what degrees of freedom in the space-time correspond to what degrees of freedom in the CFT. So how does this work explicitly? So these are the three warp factors you get for pure ADS written in DSM4 or ADS4 slicing. You get a pinch, an exponential, or a cosh. And the other interesting thing which we want to study is how do small fluctuations around those backgrounds look like. These are kind of my fields in the theory. So what you need to study for this is local linearized Einstein's equations, the second order differential equation for this fluctuation in the metric H mu nu. And the typical game you play here is you rewrite the second order differential equation as a Schrödinger equation by doing some changes of variables and changing of coordinates, just so I can draw pictures and all of us know what I'm talking about. So when I draw these potentials, these are what these really are. These are kind of just some rewritings of Einstein's equations. And you should think of them then as a quantum mechanical potential and the solution of the Hamiltonian, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian with that potential would give me the masses of the spin 2 excitations you have in the spacetime. So if you do this for the Minkowski slicing, then pure ADS looks like this. You have the boundary of ADS, which just looks like an infinite wall in this potential. So then you have a continuum of spin 2 fluctuations coming all the way down from infinite mass to zero mass. And what they do is they run against this wall and then have to exponentially decay as they go towards the boundary. So that's known physics, which we know from ADS. All my fields have to die off as they reach the boundary. And the rate at which they die off tells me something about the operator dimension of the field in the dual conformal field chain. Now, if you do this Van der Sanden procedure, what you do is you have to cut out the right half, the UV half of your space, the part close to the boundary. You take the IR part twice, and then you paste it together along the brain. And what this brain does for you, it introduces this delta function potential on top of the potential which you got from the bulk ADS. And if you study the fluctuations, you find this amazing fact. There's a localized zero mass spin 2 graviton trapped on the brain, which gives rise to this massless 4D graviton, which wasn't there in the ADS before you applied this Mendelsohn position. Okay, let's talk a little bit about holography works here, and let me do this directly into the De-Sitter 4 slicing, because that's the one that's going to be interesting for us soon. So if you do this in the DS4 slicing, pure ADS, this is again pure ADS5, looks almost the same as in the Minkowski slicing. There's a slight offset here, which basically has just something to do with how you define masses in the De-Sitter space. This 9 quarters is just what you need in order to get energies going all the way down to zero. And the UV boundary is, again, infinite high potential wall. All my fluctuations have to die exponentially as you go towards the boundary. Now we put in the brain, do Randall's syndrome. Again, same picture. I have my two IR halves of the ADS5 bulk. I get a delta function potential, which traps a localized graviton. I can calculate the Planck scale of the 4D gravitons, just L times M5 cubed. Now I want to interpret this holographically. Let's just see what we did. We did three things in here. Well, for one, we get this localized graviton. So that's easy to incorporate into holography. You just add a localized graviton to whatever else you get. You threw away some degrees of freedom. You took your ADS and you threw away this part, right? The part close to the boundary. Now comes the crucial step. You want to kind of say, what did I do in the field sweep? What degrees of freedom did I throw away? There you need this UVIR correspondence that you said, what I throw away are the UV degrees of freedom in the field sweep. So what I do is I impose a cut off on the field sweep. I just took an arbitrary energy scale and said all degrees of freedom above that are gone. And that's where the statement comes from, that Randall Sundrum is dual to conformal field theory with a cutoff living on this de Sitter space coupled to a lower dimensional graviton. And then the third step is kind of trivial, this pasting back on the same geometry again, then the interpreter is not just having one copy of the CFT, but actually having two copies of the CFT. Let me also show you how this looks like in terms of geometry. So this is my ADS-5, typical picture of ADS-5, right? Global ADS-5. And the red thing is how one of those de Sitter slices sits in there. So what you would want to do for Randall Sundrum is you keep the interior of this hyperboloid, you throw out the exterior of the hyperboloid, and you take two copies of this. This is how this de Sitter sliced Randall Sundrum solution looks like. The four-dimensional Planck mass was given by this. This was just a geometric formula. Basically, what you're measuring is this volume of this warped space-time. But there's also a 4D way of understanding this, right? By holography, there should always be this is a gravity formula. There should also be a field theory formula. The way to understand the localized graviton from the field theory point of view is that by introducing this cutoff, you get an induced Newton's constant. If you calculate the correction to the 4D Planck scale, you get to zeroth order the Planck scale that was there to begin with, which there wasn't any, so this is zero. But then you get diagrams which correct my 40 Newton's constant. Those are divergent, so you have to cut them off. They are proportional to the cutoff squared, and what's sitting out front is the number of degrees of freedom. And that's one way to derive that this number of degrees of freedom should scale like this m5 cubed l cubed to reproduce the formula you had above. The m5 l cubed you also get from this naive holographic counting in the bulk where you just count areas. ADS 5 times is 5, M5 cubed, L cubed precisely evaluates to N squared, so we knew this to be true. And you can also get the same formula about N number of degrees of freedom being M5 L cubed from doing, if you do an actual TT correlator calculations, you would get the same statement. This should somehow measure the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, once you arrive to the statement, you have to worry about, so what's actually going on at the scale 1 over L? I told you we have a duality where my conformal field series are cut off as a scale 1 over L, but the bulk is valid above that. I have bulk physics, which is well described by classical gravity all the way up to M5, and I cut off my CFT to the scale 1 over L. So I should still be able to tell you what is going on at the scale 1 over L. Well, in Randall Sundrum, there are actually two different things going on. Let me first tell you about the unpleasant one and then about the pleasant one. So here's the unpleasant one. What's going on is we threw away this UV region that's what introduced the cutoff, but instead what we put there is this brain. The brain is a thing which doesn't make this an arbitrary procedure, but which makes this a solution to Einstein's equations and allowed me to paste back on the second copy of the IR region instead of going on to the UV region. But this brain has to be, this is physics, right? There's some physics associated to the brain. The brain can fluctuate. The brain might have more degrees of freedom than Randall and Sundrum imagined. And these new degrees of freedom is something that has to be added at the scale 1 over L explicitly by hand. There are new degrees of freedom that kick in at the scale 1 over L. And if you like string theory better than Randall Sundrum toy models, then the whole thing would basically look a little bit like this. This was a story that started with Linde, and then there were many important papers in between which just got suppressed into dot, dot, dots. And KKLT is kind of the most popular incarnation of this these days, where this whole picture of, well, in this case, you also cut off the IR by some Klebanov-Strassler IR brain. You put in a UV brain, which is this Randall-Sundrum brain up here, just at tension. And string theory, what this becomes, some complicated base of a Calabi-Yau fourfold in which you kind of bunched a bunch of three brains together, which pulled out this throat. And really, if you want to study the physics of the UV brain, what's kicking in at this scale 1 over L are all these internal degrees of freedom of this complicated Calabi-Yau space. So in string theory, if you want to realize Randall Sundrum, the scale 1 over L, a lot of new degrees of freedom come in. All this microscopic physics of the Calabi-Yau, which you kind of nicely got rid of in your toy model, has to be considered again at the scale 1 over L. The other thing that happens is, even if you forget about those degrees of freedom, something else happens at 1 over L, namely gravity becomes strong. I calculated for you that the Planck scale in four dimensions is m4 squared. That's a very high scale. Gravity in four dimensions is really weak. So what do I mean by 1 over L gravity becomes strong? Well, even so, the Planck scale is m4 squared. Gravity is no longer going to be just given by Einstein-Hilbert gravity, but it receives lots of corrections once you hit the scale 1 over L. because all these matter loops are enhanced by this huge factor M5L cubed, which counted the number of degrees of freedom in my theory, I'm going to get that higher curvature corrections to my Einstein-Hilbert action are only suppressed by 1 over L squared. Even they are all, gravity is still weakly coupled to matter, but gravity, the gravitational sector itself is strongly coupled. So that's the other thing that happens at 1 over L. And also the CFTs might start talking to each other. And that's kind of the interesting physics which we want to keep. The system, even without adding new degrees of freedom, does something interesting at a scale 1 over L, which doesn't give rise to any inconsistencies or anything. Just new couplings appear at the scale 1 over L from all alone. But this all gets washed out in usual Wendel-Sundrum scenarios by having to introduce all these new degrees of freedom which are associated with the UV brain. So what would be nice, would we define a theory with a UV brain that does not introduce any new degrees of freedom at a scale 1 over L? You want to have kind of a UV brain which somehow is immaterial, doesn't contain any degrees of freedom. Well, how would you do something like this? Okay, here's one more remark. This was kind of obvious. Conformal invariance would still be broken at a scale 1 over L, right, because of the strong gravity effects. The scale 1 over L is still in the problem even if there are no new brain degrees of freedom sitting there. So you really would be nice to find a UV brain that's somehow intrinsic to the geometry. Well, one way you might try to achieve this is just take away the brain and kind of replace it by some smoothed out geometry. And then you would get, instead of this volcano potential, you'd get something smooth like this. People have written down solutions like this quite a while ago. It's very easy to come up with smooth Wendel-Sundrum domain walls. But of course, you can always write down whatever geometry you want. It's going to solve Einstein's equation as long as you put in the right stress energy tensor on the right-hand side. Right? Typical problem in Einstein gravity is everything solves it as long as you have the right stress energy tensor on the right-hand side. So it's easy to come up with smooth geometries. The question is, what is the matter that supports a smooth geometry like this? Most of the examples that were known in the past always involve the scalar field, which supports the domain wall. And then when you have the scalar field, and the scalar field introduces the new degrees of freedom itself. But here's one very interesting warp factor. If you pick your warp factor to be a log of a cosine, and ask yourself, what is the matter system that supports this warp factor? So for one, it has certainly this property. It has a UV brain, has a localized graviton. Well, what is the spacetime if I put in a log of a cosine warp factor? The spacetime just turns out to be pure De Sitter space as it is. De Sitter space has a built-in UV brain if you write it in Wendel-Sundrum coordinates. And that's very easy to see. Basically, if I write the Sitter space like this, you Wick rotate, you see this is how you would have written a five sphere to begin with. This five sphere is given in terms of the metric of the four sphere plus the zeta squared and the cosine squared zeta in front of the Sitter four metric. This wouldn't surprise you at all, but if you Wick rotate this into the Sitter, you get the statement that if you slice the Sitter five in terms of the Sitter four slices, you find precisely the same scenario as in Wendel-Sundrum. You have a localized graviton. You have a UV brain sitting there, but the UV brain doesn't come with any new degrees of freedom. It didn't have to introduce any new matter field in order to support the stress energy tensor that gives rise to that geometry. So here's basically, if you remember one thing from my talk, then you should remember the statement that the Sitter 5 is a built-in UV brain, so everything you said about Wendel-Sundrum follows right there for the Sitter as well, which basically immediately tells you that at least at this energy scale below 1 over L, gravity on the Sitter 5 is dual to gravity on the Sitter 4 plus two CFTs. And we call this argument, it's basically an argument by tautology, which is just telling you that, well, once you board into this UV IR correspondence, that close to the horizon, which is the IR, ADS and the Sitter 4 slicing, and the Sitter 5 and the Sitter 4 slicing look identical. Log of a cosine and log of a sine, log of a sinh are basically indistinguishable close to the horizon. So the IR has the same physics, and then the physics differs once you reach this UV brain. Yeah, sure, because Wendel-Sundrum has new degrees of freedom, and we don't. Okay, before I move on to the modern part of my talk, let me just draw some pictures for you. How does this De Sitter slicing of De Sitter work? So this is the picture probably most of you have seen if you've ever seen anybody talk about De Sitter space. Pando's diagram of De Sitter space is a square, which this is supposed to approximate. And so you have a north pole and a south pole, and this causal patch, the only patch that's accessible, static patch, accessible to an observer, say, sitting at the south pole, would be a little triangle like this. So how does this go together with the De Sitter slicing, which I presented for you? Well, what this De Sitter slicing is basically one way an observer sitting right smack in the center of this De Sitter space. So this OS is a world line of a static observer, different static observer, not one on this pole, but one basically sitting at the equator, which of course is related to the pole by some De Sitter transformation. You could kind of slice this diamond surrounding this world line of this guy by the sitter or person, by the sitter slices, which are given by this dotted line. So these are the sitter four slices, and my warp factor parameterizes this way over. So again, it doesn't cover all of the sitter space, but if you use on the sitter four slice a causal patch, then certainly the whole causal patch of this observer is contained within this sitter slicing. So the slicing which we presented is enough to cover the whole static patch associated with this given observer. Okay, let me summarize what I've said so far. So those of you who have heard the talk already can wake up now. Now comes something new. And just a reminder, what I hope I convinced you of, at least what I argued, is that using Wendel-Sundrum version of ADS-CFT, where you say that this R is space-time is dual to a conformal field theory with cutoff, I argue that gravity on the sitter D space has to be dual to gravity on the sitter D minus 1 plus CFT. And this, again, can be established up to scales 1 over L to the same extent that you believe this R is CFT. And if you're a purist, you can say nobody's ever proved R is CFT, which, yeah, but we all believe it because we believe IRUV. And the interesting point here is that gravity in the bulk is smarter than that, right? Gravity in the bulk goes up all the way to M5. Classical gravity only breaks down at M5, which is a scale much, much bigger than 1 over L. So my dual description should also be able to do that. And what I want to do in the rest of the talk is tell you basically, now you can go the other way around, you can use bulk gravity plus scalars plus gauge fields, whatever you want to put in the bulk. Classical fields are in the bulk. You can study it and learn about properties of this D minus one dimensional system at energy scales above 1 over L. You want to study this elusive 1 over L less than E less than M5 regime. And the idea here is that by mapping out properties of the system, well, you can see does a consistent picture arise. Right? Without an explicit example, I can't directly compare this to anything because right now I don't have an independent proposal of what this conformal field theory or this field, the theory and the D minus one dimensional theory is. But let's just see what we get by calculating gravity, and then we can all argue about whether this makes sense or not. So one of the most interesting properties of this field theory, one of the very basic things you might try to calculate is a conformal normally. And the discussion I'm going to present here is very close to what the original discussion by Hennigsen and Skinner is. So what is a conformal normally? We all learned in a conformal field theory the trace of the stress energy tensor is zero. If you actually do this for any realistic conformal field theory and happen to not study it on Minkowski space, turns out the trace of the stress energy tensor actually is not zero, but it's given by two numbers. This is in four dimensions. In two dimensions would only be one number. In even dimensions, at least, it's given by some numbers times some curvature invariance of the manifold you discuss the conformal field theory on. So that's why it's called an anomaly. Classically, it's a conformal field theory, but in the quantum level, conformal invariance gets broken. You develop these anomalies. And on flat space, they vanish. And some curved spaces, like S3 times R, it also vanishes. But on generic curved spaces, you will find that the stress of the stress energy tensor is not zero, but given by those two numbers, A and C in four dimensions. In the two-dimensional version of this, just has one number, C times R, and that's the famous central charge. In four dimensions, basically, you have two different notions of central charge. Put this little green circle around A because that's the one that has been really popular recently. That's the one that's supposedly closer to the central charge in two dimensions than the C guy. Intrilligator believes that there's some, if you follow an RG flow, or A will always decrease, which is a very nice property some central charges have. In any case, we all believe that they measure degrees of freedom. Certainly in the free theory, they do. So if you calculate A and C, this will give us some notion of how many degrees of freedom there are in our dual conformal field theory. And how do you calculate this? Why do I get anomalies from the gravity point of view? Well, in ADS, the way this arises, if you actually want to calculate the regulated action in ADS, because the action itself is infinity, if you want to regulate the action, you have to pick a metric, and the regulated action is not conformally invariant, and that's where you get this conformal anomaly from. So this is very well known in ADS. Let me just spend one transparency explaining how this works. This was done by Hennigsen and Skinderis following a proposal by UW people. So this kind of what was one of the main important contributions of UW to ADS-CFT was actually done way before ADS-CFT. Pfefferman and Graham basically wrote down these coordinate systems which are important to study this, in particular the conformal anomaly. So the recipe in ADS in order to calculate any quantity in the gravity gauge theory correspondence is to take the classical action and evaluate it on the solution. So if you just have gravity in the bulk, which is the one thing which we definitely want to have, the action is just root VR, and if I evaluate this in ADS, I just get a constant. So basically, in order to calculate the classical action on the solution, what you end up is calculating the volume of ADS. And that's where the infinity comes from, right? ADS has infinite volume. So what you have to do is you have to cut off the thing. You don't want to really integrate over the full five-dimensional volume, but you only want to integrate it out to some value where this warp factor e to the r becomes very large, some fixed large number, and this epsilon is a small quantity as usual, so 1 over epsilon is some large number. And then you take all the terms that go like 1 over epsilon to some power, and you cancel them by some counter terms, and or in the Mandel-Sandrum setup, you actually don't even do this, you keep them, and they're finite terms, and they're there, in particular, for example, this M Planck, the four-dimensional Planck scale, was one of those finite terms that arose this way. And the interesting thing are terms that go like log epsilons, and they are the anomaly. So how does this work? If you look at the actual Hendrickson Scanderis papers, it looks rather complicated because they try to do this for general background metrics. But if you're just happy to pick a few, this is actually a very simple calculation, right? All we want to do is calculate the volume of ADS. So if you do this in flat by slicing, you end up, the warp factor was an e to the r, so I integrate e to the 4r, that's just the root g. Integral of e to the 4r is e to the 4r. This is epsilon to the fourth, no log epsilon, no anomaly. If I do this in ADS slicing, my warp factor was a cosh. If you just go to Mathematica and say integrate cosh to the fourth power, you get a sinh 4r, sinh 2r, and there's a 12r sitting smack there. That's a conformal anomaly. So this was all in ADS. How do we do this in DIS? Do we have to reinvent the wheel? Well, there's a nice trick of how you can make use of all those ADS recipes and apply them to our DS-DS correspondence. Realize the following. Writing down the de Sitter metric in this conformal C coordinate, which is just related to the R coordinate, the DC over cosh is DR. Then you get the de Sitter 5 space in de Sitter 4 slicing has a 1 over cosh squared sitting out front. If you do the same for ADS, you would get a 1 over sinh squared out front. So ADS and de Sitter space are related by a conformal transformation. The ADS metric in de Sitter slicing is related to the DS metric in de Sitter slicing by 1 over 10 squared sitting out front. So if you do a simple change of variables, G, the metric goes to 10 squared G, you can take the de Sitter metric and map it into the ADS metric. And whatever you need for doing ADS space, you just keep on doing and apply it to de Sitter space. It sounds a little fishy. There must be somewhere the physics of de Sitter space must be hiding in this. Well, it's hiding in that under this change of variables, your action actually changes. Before, we wanted to study on ADS space Einstein-Hilbert action. Now what we want to study is Einstein-Hilbert action in the Sitter space. Now I apply my change of variables, and then you see what's happening is that Einstein-Hilbert action actually becomes Einstein-Hilbert action with position-dependent Planck scale, plus some things which are like cosmological terms, which ensure that you actually get back your de Sitter solution. But the most interesting part in this is that if you want to study gravity in de Sitter space, you might as well study gravity in anti-de Sitter space, but the way you have to study is you have to have introduced a position-dependent Planck scale. Having done this, you can just go back to your standard recipes. I have a new action, but I can still calculate my correlation functions by evaluating the actions on solutions. That's no problem anymore. I just have to make sure that I use the right actions. So if I want to describe de Sitter spaces, I can do calculations in ADS with a position-dependent Planck constant. And in particular, the position-dependent Planck constant tells me that gravity becomes actually strong as you move the boundary. You can also do the same for scalar fields. Scalar fields are always very instructive. For a scalar field, the effect is a little bit less dramatic. The kinetic term reproduces itself, but the mass term in the Sitter space, which was just an ordinary mass term, becomes a position-dependent mass in ADS. We also want to interpret this later. So one caveat with this is that basically what's happening if you do this conformal map, you map all of the Sitter space, you map all of ADS into half of the Sitter space. I only take the left half or the right half and map it to ADS. The UV brain, which I had in my scenario before, maps to the boundary of ADS. So what this technique is going to do is nicely capture the physics of each one of those CFT factors. The one thing where you have to work harder, where you have come up with a new recipe, is you want to actually figure out how do those two CFTs talk to each other. There's still something that has to be there in the 5D gravity, but there you have to reinvent the wheel and come up with some new recipes, as opposed to just using standard ADS CFT knowledge. Okay, so now I can do my gravity calculations. I can just take the action, evaluate on the solution. So the solution is basically pure de Sitter space. It's mapped to pure ADS. Here's the answer you get. The conformal normally is 0. A is equal to C, and both are equal to 0. A equals C had to happen as soon as you have any gravitational action which doesn't involve R, I, J, K, L. You're guaranteed that A is going to be equal to C. The 0 at first sounds rather surprising. Well, at second, then you say, well, after all, it's not so surprising at all, right? If I do the 2D version of this, we have the sitter 3 mapped to the sitter 2. I have quantum gravity in two dimensions coupled to some matter system. Well, just open Polchinski chapter 3. He tells you, take any theory in two dimensions, couple it to quantum gravity. Doesn't really matter whether it was conformal or not, what was the central charge. Unless you are smart enough to pick set conformal field theory and C equals to 26 to begin with, you're going to get this Liouville mode. The Liouville mode doesn't decouple. And what it's going to do, it's going to make your full matter and gravity system into a CFD with C equals 0 always, no matter what your matter conformal field theory was. So now you go back and say, ah, well, then this isn't really that surprising. All I found is this obvious statement which people knew long ago from studying 2D quantum gravity string theory worksheets. Well, basically, we still think, for one, there's something interesting there, even if it were just that trivial, because we say it still works, and the same is basically happening in any D in this particular DSDS setups. We would get that in any dimension D, you would have a similar mechanism that you throw some conformal field theory or even non-conformal field theory to the gravity system, and what it's going to do, it's going to cancel out the conformal anomaly from all alone by basically making the scale factor dynamic. But more than that, the story is actually more complicated than what we just said. Now we did it for the SDS, and if you don't like the SDS, you can go back and say, well, actually, does the same happen in Mendel-Sundrum, right? People haven't talked about this in RS. But in RS, we have the same situation, right? I have a three-dimensional, say if I do a 3D RS version, I get a 2D CFT coupled to gravity. Shouldn't I get central charge equal to zero as well, just by the same I told you before? Well, let's do this. Instead of having the singular RS wall, which is just means I put explicitly degrees of freedom at the boundary, which is kind of hard to deal with, let's take a smoothed out RS wall. I can apply the same trick. This is going to be described by some warp factor in the C coordinate. I can still conformally map this to ADS. I can calculate the conformal anomaly the same way as I did before. And I find that the norm A is equal to C still. That was kind of guaranteed. But they're usually not zero. They're proportional to the width of the scalar field at the wall. If I insist on building my RS wall out of a scalar field instead of having it got given to me by studying the sitter space, I find that generically I get a conformal anomaly unless the scalar field vanishes on the wall, the derivative of the scalar field vanishes on the wall. If you think about how one of those domain walls look like, they're just standard kink domain walls. I have the tension of the brain is given by a derivative in the scalar field. Generically, phi prime, the derivative of the scalar field, is maximal on where I want the brain to be. The warp factor has the usual RS shape. So this is certainly something which does not vanish in general. I can make it vanish if I really want to. Right? If I play these RS games and don't insist on things coming out of strings here, I can just put in the scalar with whatever potential I desire. If I fine-tune the scalar potential, I can come up with kink solutions which have kind of this property that it's like a double kink. You have a kink which, instead of going straight through, kind of has a dimple in the center where phi prime becomes zero right on the brain, and then I would get back the conformal anomaly being zero. So if I fine-tune my scalar potential, I can achieve conformal anomaly being zero, but it's certainly not a generic situation. Already in Randall-Sundrum, or in Randall-Sundrum, you would think the conformal anomaly is not zero, even so you couple to lower dimensional gravity. So this should be a puzzle to people who kind of study string theory and do the 3D, 2D version of RS and believe that the central charge should go away as soon as I couple to 2D gravity. Here's our interpretation, or our current thinking on this, and that's really something where we could still need some feedback because we're kind of challenging conventional wisdom. I hope not too much. But the way you can think about this is what phi prime is. Phi prime means I turned on an irrelevant operator in this conformal field theory. I did something to my conformal field theory that makes it ill-behaved in the UV. And the only way to get the central charge equal to zero is if I fine-tune this irrelevant operator to be very nice behaved in the UV. So basically approach the UV fixed point. That's another way of saying that you want phi prime to be zero at the brain. So my interpretation of this is that 2D gravity isn't really as strong as people always said it should be. 2D gravity can't handle whatever. 2D gravity can only handle some things. But we are still quite unclear what the rule is. But it seems to be that if you, well, I think the arguments people always present tell you, if you take a well-defined 2D field theory, some UV-complete system, throw it at 2D gravity, yeah, for sure, it's going to make it a C equals zero system once you couple it to matter, to gravity. Well, what we seem to be finding, if you take something that's not well-defined in UV, you don't know. Sometimes you're going to get C equals zero, but the generic situation is certainly not going to be that you get C equals zero. 2D gravity doesn't seem to be handled whatever. And the generic irrelevant operator leads to an uncontrolled UV behavior, and you get a non-zero central charge. 2D gravity isn't strong enough to make this zero. same in 4D. Mendel syndrome, the generic Mendel syndrome, smooth Mendel syndrome wall is not going to give you a vanishing central charge. On the contrary, the sitter has C equals zero, and we take this as our first. Yes?
I was just wondering whether you could go back to Distler and others.
Distler Kawai? Yeah, I wish, yeah. I'm sure one can, but this is what... People usually don't do that, right? They always tell you, well, I perturb my conformal field theory with these operators, and then they already kind of assume you're starting with a fixed point defining your non-conformal system. They don't really entertain this possibility too much, right? Usually if you look at this discussion in the literature, they always start with, here are my operators by which I perturb my conformal system, and then they get dressed. And, this is not the kind of question they like to address. Well, I'm certainly puzzled, and I believe my collaborators are too, but we are not...
Define the central charge in the theory of gravity? I thought it was sort of just truly zero, but the theory doesn't depend on the metric.
Well, I told you what I calculate. I calculate this holographic way.
But I mean, just in general, when you say theory of gravity, it doesn't matter, I say. What is the central charge? I think the way you can define it.
The trace of the stress energy tensor, isn't this something I can still calculate?
But that just doesn't matter, so I can generically...
Yeah, no, this should be the coupled system, right? This would be...
I thought it was the same, since the metric is a variable, that means that you shift the Weyl factor, which is a definition of your field, so it's trivial.
But if you want to write the liberal system with these only, it's going to be as well, and the world comes in.
Oh, which is zero.
Come with the gravity.
No, no, the liberal system...
Yeah, when you add it to the matter, then it's zero, but on its own, it has some central charge.
Right, in fact, the whole theory together was zero. I thought it was just sort of a consistency check that you were doing things sensibly.
Well, the claim is here, to do things sensibly, you actually need the field theory which is void matter to have certain properties, otherwise you don't get the sensible answer.
Question. You take something which is not Gauss-Bonnet gravity in two dimensions, and presumably there's some big loopholes in this type of argument. The statement that you get VSOR constraints is that the let's say usual Einstein-Hilbert term it is a total derivative in two dimensions. But you also have R squared and stuff like that, presumably that will also violate any, let's say, common wisdom on this stuff.
Could be. Because certainly, I mean, we are now talking about UV properties of the theory which are beyond the scale 1 over L, which is precisely where at least these higher curvature terms are going to kick in. Yeah, that would be an interesting option. I mean, I know how to calculate this piece from the gravity point of view, and you just get a non-zero answer, and that seems to be at least something that tells me at some point the conventional story has to break down. Maybe it just tells me that there wasn't a consistent decoupled theory there to begin with, but...
I mean, some other way you had to be the sitter space and I computed the Euclidean action or something.
Well, in the sitter space, I get C equals zero and everything is, this was my conclusion here, right? In DSDS, we get, fortunately, we do get C equals zero and everything's well defined. We don't have to introduce any new degrees of freedom. We get a perfectly nice and well behaved story, and you should worry Lisa and Raman about why they get an inconsistent story. How about the scalars? Well, I told you for the scalars, I get a precision dependent mass. And what does a precision-dependent mass translate to into ADS? Well, you get a scale-dependent scale dimension, RG running, basically. So if you look at the dimensions of your scalar fields in the game, in the IR, where we basically have ADS physics, the dimension of the scalar fields is just set by their mass, right? There's this usual formula that delta times D minus delta has to be equal to M squared. IR physics gives me different dimensions for all the fields. But if you run out to the UV, you see the way this mass runs is that all scalar fields in the game, no matter what their mass is, end up having the same scale dimension. If you go to the five-dimensional case, what the scale dimension turns out is equal to 3/2. So if you pick the other one, it would be 5/2, but we have good reason to believe that 3/2 has to be the right value. Well, for one, this is the value you get for the conformally coupled field, and that's kind of obvious because the conformally coupled scalar didn't care about the conformal transformation which you did to begin with, so it should have the same value as in ADS. And 3/2 is just the right answer. If you want to come up with some dictionary that somehow the correlation function of the operators have to know about 5D Green's function at short distance on ADS is just flat space 5D Green's function. you should get a 1 over x cubed, which you get if you have your operators have dimension 3/2. So the 3/2 seems to be a metric value, and what you get is that indeed all scalars run to this 3/2 dimension. How does this fit in with our with the words which we like to say? Well, once you have the Liouville field playing a crucial role in setting your central charge equal to zero, you know that the Liouville field has to do more. It's going to address all my operators. And for sure, it's not too surprising that the operators are going to pick up some dimensions which are different from the naive dimensions, because here, the operators you should be talking about, physical operators, are the ones which are addressed by some power of the Liouville mode. Why 3/2 is still a puzzle which we like to understand a little better. But the fact that we get this gravitational dressing for our operators, that shouldn't be too surprising. Okay, let me summarize the second part, and then I'm briefly going to conclude by telling you all the things which we believe to know and I won't have any time to tell you about. So my second part was an attempt to map out some properties of this lower dimensional system, of this field theory coupled to lower dimensional gravity, which we say has to be dual to the Sitter space in D dimensions. And we do this by using the bulk description. And we believe a consistent story emerges where the lower dimensional gravity dresses the conformal field theory into universal closed. So depending on what theory you have in the Sitter space, you're going to get a different CFT in four dimensions or in the lower dimensional theory. But no matter what your CFT precisely is, in the UV, gravity is always going to make the C equal zero and going to dress all my operators to be, all the scalar operators are going to get dressed to half dimension. D over 2 minus 1, that's the generalization to D dimensions of the 3/2 I had before. An explicit example would be desirable. So if I wrote down some examples which define for you a dual conformal field theory to the Sitter space in terms of something that's living on some brains, which includes an S brains, which why it's not so explicit. But certainly there is some, it's not like there's no idea out there of what this conformal field theory is. Sometimes in string theory, we like to define series like the little string series, the way it was originally defined, is roughly at the same level, right? You say, here are my brains, and whatever's living on them, that I call my conformal field theory. So at that level, there's a definition out there of one example of the SDS. Okay, to conclude, let me tell you all the other things which we have studied a little bit in the system, which we believe are pretty cool, but I won't have time to tell you about. Most of all, you can study other space times, right? So far, I was talking about the SDS. You can, on the very similar spirit, you can study similar spacetimes, like bubble-bubble. Bubble-bubble duality also holds. That's, if you want to study KKLT, you have to deal with the fact that eventually your beautiful De Sitter is going to die. There's going to be some bubble which takes it, well, first of all, to a De Sitter, which is a smaller cosmological constant. Because time is time, bubble in De Sitter D becomes bubble in De Sitter D minus 1. The vacuum decay in De Sitter D maps to a very similar effect decay in the De Sitter D minus 1. So there has to be now a property of this conformal field theory that allows a domain wall which eventually is going to transmit that decay. So KKLT is something we can deal with. It's not a puzzle for us. It's something that fits beautifully into our framework. At least as long as you don't insist on making me decay to flat space, then I have to worry a little more. Inflation. So if you now ask what happens if I don't stick with one cosmological constant, but say have something like this, where I start with a large cosmological constant, which you want to call inflation, have some intermediate period where all kinds of nasty stuff happens, like you and me, and then in the end we get De Sitter again with a smaller cosmological constant, then this is also something you can deal with. How does this look like if you want to study it in D dimension? How does it look like in D minus one dimension? Well, it's the same type of spacetime. Roughly, you get a position-dependent RG flow. You have something that looks like an RG flow, but different points in space, you have a different RG flow. And without drawing pictures, it's very hard to make this more precise. But this, people had this picture before that this should be something like an RG flow, like fixed point in between some evolution. In this DSCFT correspondence, this was something people actually advertised already, but they always needed the infinite time to make sense of the Sitter space with all its problems. For us, this comes out naturally also in our framework as this inflation correspondence. Now we can keep on going. There's also something like a black hole correspondence. So what happens if you put a black hole into the bulk? Now it actually depends on how you slice your bulk. One way to arrange things is that you get the CFT for something which has finite temperature. But right now, I think the more interesting version of this is to actually put the black hole in the bulk in such a way that you end up getting a black hole on the brain as well. So the black hole in the D-dimension theory is dual to a black hole in the D-1 theory. But interestingly enough, this is not just a pure black hole. This is a black hole including all its Hawking radiation, because my 40 gravity is coupled to the CFT with all its quantum effects being there. That's something people discussed in RS many times. That's basically one of the reasons why it's so hard to write down brain world black holes, because brain world black holes have to include all the back reaction of its Hawking radiation. In this case, it's actually trivial. So we can write down in this CFT gravity system, we can write down exact black hole solution with all its Hawking radiation taken care of, its back reaction. Then what it is just really the one higher dimensional black hole. You can check at least that this Hawking radiation, which you turn on, it's non-zero, but its trace is zero as it should, because we don't have a conformal anomaly. So it works, and this is, I like to call this the first explicit solution for a brain world black hole, albeit maybe not the most interesting one. This is certainly not what people were hunting for, but at least we can write down the solution just by writing down the five-dimensional black hole. It's a five. You write down the 5D Schwarzschild black hole. The way it looks on the 4D brain, it's a 4D Schwarzschild black hole. Just with whenever you see the this 1 over r to the d minus 2, you still stick in 5 instead of 4 for d. It has the wrong power of r instead. Can I have some light?
In the center of the sitter space. And doesn't it intersect the boundary?
Right, so this is my de Sitter hot tin can, and the center is my black hole. Now you can ask, where's the slice on which the graviton is 5D, right?
Yeah, okay.
So this is a slice on which the graviton is localized. So how does this look on the slice? It's a black hole. And if you write down the metric for this on the slice, it's just going to be minus h dt squared plus dr squared over h plus r squared d omega 2 squared. Now because it's 4D, it's a. So this looks like, you ask me what happened, it's like a 4D black hole. Well, the secret is that this h is still 1 minus r squared over l squared plus m, or some new parameter, sorry, minus mu over r to the second power. So you still have, this is why it's not a 4D Schwarzschild black hole. That's basically the whole quantum correction, all the Hawking radiation is doing, it's promoting the 1 over r into 1 over r squared. And you can just calculate what is, I mean, now you go backwards, right? You calculate what is rij of this beast and what is rij kl of this beast, or, I mean, you don't need the four. And then you stick it back in and ask what is the Hawking radiation that gives rise, supports this. And the one consistency check you can do is that whatever Hawking radiation you find is traces.
It's nowhere near a vacuum
no.
solution in the DS lower dimension.
No.
It's supported by.
Yeah, by this, yes.
Is very strong.
Because you have a huge
energy. Yes, that's why. Yes. Well, the advertisers, they were the ones who pointed out you shouldn't be surprised to not find the static black holes in the brain worlds, because you have to take into account the Hawking radiation. And then in this 3D version, you can write down explicit solutions, you have to see metrics. So they find that basically conical deficits get dressed by the Hawking radiation to become things with finite horizons. Okay, you're kind of about the first explicit, the first explicit 4D solution for that. They did, No, they did. I mean, when I said maybe I should have put their names here, I mean, certainly this whole discussion on this transparency was strongly motivated by their paper, which kind of, they were the ones who, at least, I there's supposedly some person whose name I forgot who is in Japan who simultaneously pointed out the same fact. But those three guys were the ones whose paper I read and made me understand that this is actually true. That the brain world black holes are so complicated because the classical gravity solution in the bulk actually is the quantum corrected gravity solution in the brain. That came from them, and they had explicit examples in the 4D, 3D version where things are more easy and where you have explicit solutions, even in RS. Right, one more transparency. Let me end up with some open questions in the hope that some of you start actually working on this. So what we definitely need to understand is, or what would be nice to understand, to actually come up with some examples which offer checks. And the one thing which I told you in the beginning, which this might be useful for, is to find out whether holography had any imprint on the CMB possibly or not. I don't know if the answer to this is yes or no. I'm kind of pessimistic because Raphael tells me no, and Raphael usually is always right. But there's at least should be the framework in which you can address this meaningfully. Otherwise you can just do counting arguments, right? This is something where you can calculate things in principle and hopefully get out the right answers. Flat space would of course still be interesting, because when I say I can take care of KKLT, Well, we can really only do this, the S goes to the SDK. If you actually want to go to flat space, there are all types of issues there. In some sense, basically what happens in flat space, if you calculate the central charge again, it's not equal to zero. The number of degrees of freedom seems to grow in the UV like crazy. You can write the metric in the same form, but instead of a cos or a cosine, you get an, instead of a cos or a sin, you just get an exponential out front. So flat space is something which doesn't quite fit into our framework yet. And even in this mapping out, I didn't put this here because it's a little bit more technical, but that's certainly something which can be attacked earlier, is if you want to map out CFT physics using the bulk physics, we haven't really understood yet in detail how the two CFTs communicate with each other. That's the obvious next thing which on that avenue still has to be explored. All right, thank you. Thank you.